That, however, is the first thing you have to recognize here, for until you have done so there is no hope of progress for you. Ph. You do not accept my words now. They will come back to you in the midst of your agony and will be of help to you then. That is why I have spoken in this way to you. So, instead of doctor, you will be called Paul, for you are little of stature and, at present, of little worth. Stand up and verify my words. He dared not disobey her quietly spoken command. But when he stood up as she had bidden him, he was staggered at the fact that, while she was just fairly proportioned, the crown of his head was only on a level with her shoulder. In earth life he would have been much taller than she. Now you see what I mean, she continued. Remember that, although that name is yours henceforth, yet it has been borne by good and bad in the history of earth. Fix your mind, when you are able to do so, on the good, and on the most famous of all, who one day may be able to help you if you show your worthiness in the end to bear his name. Yes, you can do this, but your pilgrimage will be a long and weary one. This man has come that way, too, and has in part learned his lesson. You are committed into his keeping for the present time, until you begin to descend the valley of the rocks. Do not take alarm. You will not be driven there. When you will go of your own will, and not until you drive yourself that way will you go. Meanwhile, this man has you in charge. It is a test and a task for him, and according as he performs this task will his next steps lie towards or away from peace. He is called Albert, for no particular reason. He chose it himself. It happened to be his name on earth and, until earth influences are done away, he prefers to retain it. I am going to leave you now. Is there any question you would like to ask me before I go? Yes. I want to know by what right you have consigned me to the care of this man. The question is not one of right, so much as of love. You do not understand that, for love has found little place in your heart, being crowded out by selfishness. I, therefore, reply as will best help you. Thus, the first thing you had better do is to grapple with the fact that you are completely in the power of the evil rulers of these realms, except for the help of such as I. If you do not admit this of your own free will, you will be ground down and crushed into submission. Not by me, nor by any of my order, but by those same dark rulers and their subordinates. Under their power you must pass, for you paid your allegiance to them in your earth life, although you little realized that fact then. But, while you have this short respite, I advise you to cultivate the ability in yourself of accepting what help I and Albert are able to give you. For such a link made now, will bind us to you when you are down there. When you are no longer willing, and indeed able, to stay in these parts, and leave for the darker places, then I will come to you once again. At that time also this man will give account to me of his dealings with you. Then she turned to Albert and said solemnly, and with a touch of tenderness, Albert, my little child snatched from those red worlds below, I have gone through much travail for you, and you are not yet fully born into the light of his presence. Remember this and my love for you and your loved one. She is penitent now, and her love for you has returned to her and is breaking her heart for sorrow of the grief she caused you. She will soon be coming out of earth's troubles to grapple with what penance she has stored up here. But she will not come so far downwards as this, for she is already working out her salvation in grief and repentance and love for you. Be careful, therefore, that your account to me of your dealings with this unhappy man be such that I may be able to take you a little way onward where you may meet her when she comes. In that case you and she shall travel together, helping one another on towards the light. Remember. Then intently she looked at Paul, as we must now call him, but there was no sign of softening in his face. So she slowly turned, walked to the door and went forth. And as she went the air seemed to become more chill, and what little light there was changed somewhat, and whereas before there had been a slight rosy hue blended in it, that was now withdrawn, and it was very gloomy without it. It was then Paul realized his abject poverty and degradation. He had been used to do much as he would with people hereto, and they seldom had stood against his dominating personality. Now a young girl scolded him and called him small and poor, and shamed him. She commanded him, this slip of a girl. And he dared not defy her, for he knew that, with all her sweetness, she was strong, and he was weak and poor. No friend, of all his many friends, was there, but only enemies who had just cause for vengeance. He was there in the gloom and alone in his great weakness. Thursday, January 16, 1919, 5.45 to 6.20 p.m. The street into which they entered was but a single line of huts facing open country. It stretched away and downward until it became lost in the gloom. There was no horizon. Here and there flickered a lurid light like a small wood fire of green and copper-colored flames. Most of the place was apparently bogland, for there arose from it a stench of decaying matter which was borne about in fumes most revolting and suffocating. Paul gasped for breath and leaned against a fence for support. But it gave way as soon as he touched it and he fell headlong into a muddy enclosure. Albert began to laugh, and then checked himself and, going forward, helped the wretched man to regain the pavement of cobblestones. "For pity's sake," cried Paul, "what is this place, and is there no way to get out of it?" His companion now became very serious as he looked at him. He paused for a time, and then said, "That plot is called a garden, but the best flowers it will grow are a kind of fungus/mushroom. It's a garden only by courtesy, or perhaps so-called in deference to that cold cynicism, mixed with make-believe, of which you will find here more than a sufficiency. You see, I am beginning to be able to stand aside from things and look at them from a partly detached point of view. That, however, was not always so, and it is a sign of my progress. But I find I am not yet on very firm ground. I nearly laughed at your plight just now. That was a bit of the old devil in me which I thought I had left behind down there. I would rather have your ridicule than your pity, anyhow. Yes, I think I understand, sort of coals of fire feeling, isn't it? But I want you to realize that my pity is quite sincere. No one who has been through what I have been through could help pitying one like you, who has even a worse hell journey before him than I had." Paul shuddered and peered through the gloom into his companion's face and asked, "Why do you say that? Why tell me in advance? Not to add to your torture, as you are imagining. I cannot say I have quite forgiven you for what you did to me. I don't think I can do that until you come to me and ask for my forgiveness. But I am trying to get ready for that time. So what I do and say is only for your good. I want you to bear that in mind. It will make things easier both for you and me. I told you of your fate in advance to help you to realize fact. For many years you have been trying to blind yourself as to what you really were and the future in store for you when you should come over here. If you will take the advice of one who has been through it, you will drop that insane attitude and own up to what you really are." "What do you mean by that? Well, what is your opinion of your life?" "I have not lived the life of a saint. I never pretended to do that. I'm not a hypocritical local preacher. Not a local preacher, certainly, but a hypocrite, yes." "How do you mean?" "I don't feel inclined to stand any lectures from you, and certainly not insults." Albert again paused. "I am only just beginning my present work, it is quite new to me, and I hardly know how to deal with you as I have been instructed to do. You seem to be rather a difficult case for me to start with. I wish you would explain, and not talk riddles like a fool. My poor fellow, you are adopting your old style, overbearing, hard-faced and bullying. You were ever so, I remember. But here it is not only out of place in such as you, it is insolent, and I advise you to drop it, once and for all, and adopt a much humbler attitude, for you will presently find yourself in the company of such as will resent it in a way you will not relish very much. Is there no law in this place? Look at yourself. In your shrunken, ugly figure, in the coarse rags which clothe you, you may read an open page of the book of that unerring law which is in operation everywhere - even here. In earth life you are able to clothe your body with expensive clothes, and to mask your black soul with clever words or a smile or a money gift. Here you are what your appearance declares you to be, that exactly, and nothing else. Then this is really permanent, not just a bad dream, I mean. It is neither one nor the other. Certainly it is real enough, as I have found, and you will find also. But I have lately come to believe that this state is not permanent. There is a way out, I'm almost sure of it." which is the way out. Can't we go to it? I am suffocating here. It is like drowning in a sea of bad slimy fog. Well, not fog exactly, because you can see through it. Look yonder. Paul looked and, far away, he saw a hill with a cleft in it. Between the cleft there shimmered a glow which evidently came from a light which proceeded from some country beyond. That is the way out, so I am told, said Albert. Then let us make for it in double quick time. Not so. That is the point I am slowly and toilsomely making for, and hope to reach some day. But I had to go by that darker road to get even thus far. He pointed in the opposite direction. As they stood there gazing out into the darkness, the whole dimly lighted country seemed so horrible that Paul shuddered as if he had an ague. Now and then a wail came out of the blackness, as of one who had lost all hope of betterment and was in much pain. Then a ruddy flash would leap up and, in its light, forms horrible were seen, some tearing each other in frenzied anger, or in attitudes loathsome and more horrible still. Paul uttered a cry of terror. The more fool you, he cried. I am not going to have any of that, if I can help it. You can stay here if you choose, you seem poor-spirited enough, anyway. I'm going straight for that cleft in the hill yonder, and, he added threateningly, you are not going to stop me, either. No, I shall not try to stop you. I shall be waiting here for you when you return. P14 Paul cast a doubtful glance on him, which turned gradually into one of contempt. Then he flung round and plunged into the darkness in the direction of the light between the peaks. Chapter 2 Lost in Hell. Friday, January 17, 1919, 5.45 to 7.15 p.m. There were two others who witnessed the departure of Paul into the darkness which lay toward the faraway light. I mean the two women. The younger woman had been in the darkness since her passing over. At first her agony was very sharp indeed. But that soon passed into a state of continuous sadness and remorse which, in its turn, blossomed into repentance. It was at this point that she was brought into contact with Albert. I say brought for, although they do not fully know it, even in those dark places they are watched by the bright ones who report faithfully to their leaders as to the conditions of each of the myriads scattered over those vast continents of gloom. Thus at the proper moment they were brought together. That moment was when it was known that their mutual enemy, the doctor, was about to be called upon to render up his account. That reckoning began with their entrance into his cell, which I have explained to you. May I interrupt to ask, is this a true story or fiction? All questions put by Mr. Vale Owen are printed in brackets. True enough, my friend, and, in essentials, repeated by the thousand times. But as regards this story in particular, yes, it is a history of real persons, and the incidents I shall give you are true ones. P15 But I must qualify that by saying that I can only give you as near a copy of the original picture as it is possible with the material your earth language affords. It is like asking a person to describe a very intricate problem in astronomical mathematics and limiting him to those words only that he will hear on a morning's visit to Billingsgate Market and no other. Do you get a glimmering of our task, good friend? I will add, however, that the people I mention are all real personalities, and that the transactions herein disclosed are all known at first hand to one or other of the band who are using me as their instrument of transmission of these messages to you. Thank you, Kathleen, I see what you mean. Oh, of course. I know you mean that nicely. But, my friend, forgive me when I say your statement is a little too positive. You have only a faint glimmering of what I mean. In my question I used that word designedly. When you come over here you will understand. Now let us cease from this gossip and get to the real business. You are a wee bit hoity-toity, aren't you, Kathleen? Did you ever know such an amanuensis? My good friend, do please get to work and take down what I am able to get into your erratic consciousness. All right, I suppose you must have the last word. Being a woman, why don't you say it? It was in your mind, and you shirked writing it. You see, you are open to me like a book. Now I am copying a bad example and digressing also. Let us continue. It is a sad enough history, goodness knows, and all this levity is quite out of place.
Yes, and I'd like. Now, my dear good soul, do please allow me to resume.
Quite right, Kathleen, I was only about to venture, very meekly, the remark, how I enjoy your little swear, it was so human.
Whatever do you mean?
The goodness knows. It was quite a relief to me to get that.
Pause of 2 minutes.
Yes, I did say it. I did not know I had done so. I have just asked and sister, that is our present leader informs me, with a smile, that I have been kicking over the traces, as you would say. Your questions came in between me and those who were giving me the message, and then a little bit of me just slipped through, the human me, as you truly said. I would advise you to cut out the whole passage, both questions and answers, it is neither elegant nor edifying.
Not for worlds, dear lady. I've got it down, and there it sticks, as you please. Now to resume.
It was clearly explained to them why they had been brought together. They were both injured people, and both had taken their injury in the wrong way.
Listen. This is one of the most important lessons for people to learn while in the earth life. That qualification is emphatic. It is much more difficult to undo here any wrong committed, or wrong course taken, while on earth, than it is to do so in the earth life.
Why?
I don't know, but it is so invariably.
One moment, I will ask.
Pause of 1 minute. The best way to put it is this, while in earth life the material body and environment make a much better background on which to build up your image. Or, to vary it, thus, unspiritual people, on being deprived of their material body and its environment, find themselves in a spiritual body and surroundings governed according to spiritual laws operating in a larger dimension of space. Having sinned against, or neglected to study and use, spiritual quantities, they are at a disadvantage when those quantities are all they have to hand. This is the best we can do, I fear.
So the task and opportunity were put before them, the task of helping one who had cruelly wronged them both, the opportunity of definitely taking their turn round towards the light by doing this service. If they could carry this out, it would be their first definite step towards those dark hills against which the light shone from the country, the better land, beyond. I have showed you how Albert had begun. Now he stepped aside for a while. It was Monica's turn. She followed Paul into the wilderness into which he had plunged headlong in his defiance and frenzy. She knew the district fairly well, for it was here she had spent most of her time after her first sharp agony was over. It was the region of lesser darkness. The air, as the mountain range was neared, became of a somewhat lighter substance and less rank than obtained in the region behind. For this reason, the further she went, the more alert became she in brain and the more vigorous in body, being acclimatized, as it were, to that region. But Paul, on the contrary, found that the further he went the more the blackness increased and the more difficult was it to breathe the less dense atmosphere about him. He stumbled along with the grim determination of despair. He found that he was upon a hard and uneven path, evidently running along the side of the mountain. He could scarcely see, but with his hand he felt the rock surface on his right. Careful investigation showed him that on the left, the cliff fell sheer away into black depth. As he went on in his increasing blindness, he guided himself by touch alone. For the darkness became more dense and, at last, he could see nothing at all. His only guidance was the rock. Feeling his way thus, he suddenly gave vent to a shriek of horror and fear. He had placed his hand, not upon the rock, but upon what felt like a wet and slimy thick rope hanging down the cliff. He was just wondering if this was a means of ascent, when the rope stiffened and squirmed, and a hissing came from a spot a few yards above his hand. He hastily withdrew and stepped back. But his cry had informed the monster of his whereabouts, so he fled back on the way he had come. But when he retraced his steps, as he supposed, to the place where he had left the others, he paused and looked around him. He could see nothing, all was intense blackness. He carefully felt about him on hands and knees and found that he was still on the pass, with cliff on one side and abyss on the other. Then he sat down and wondered how he had first come upon that path. But he could not remember the moment when he had left the plain for these hills.
Evidently he was in the midst of a mountainous district infested with reptiles, and what other horrors he feared to speculate. He was alone and lost. As he sat there he became aware of another horror, silence. Silence in the heavenly places is one of the most exquisite delights of all those sweet things which are stored in those golden treasure cities of the blessed. In the hells it is horrible. The name of God on the lips of the thousands of the angelic choir, which floats and pulses over the welkin of heaven's mountain, dale, grove, wherever it finds place and passage, ravishes those who hear it with joy unspeakable. I have seen two people walking along an avenue in the forest when, softly murmuring, came the far distant echoes of the angelic hymn. They too paused and stood still, and their bosoms heaved in yearning, their cheeks glowed with the ecstasy of the sound. And at length, bereft of speech and overcome by emotion, both lowered the curtain of their eyes, fell on each p20 other's neck, and the remained, the face of each laid on his companion's shoulder, silent and still until the music died away. It was a hymn of adoration to our only benefactor, and a tribute of love to love's fountain. It was a song of God. But in the hells the speaking of any of his names is forbidden by those who rule there, for it sends a thrill of agony wherever it is heard. So it is with silence. When none else stirs up sound, then God's presence filling all the apparent void is more emphasized. That is why silence in the heavens is holy, and in the hells accursed. Here on that lonely mountain pass Paul felt this for the first time, and for the first time realized his own vileness, who a few hours before had returned home congratulating himself that he was a lucky fellow. He had purchased and furnished a beautiful house, was making plenty of money and, well, he is only one of many, as I sadly grieve to know. God help them, for it is a sorry lot in store for them, when they come over here. Dark and selfish thoughts make the outer world similar. On the Astral Friday, January 24, 1919, 5.45 to 6.35 p.m. Paul sat there crouching upon the rough path in ever-increasing uneasiness of mind, till inaction became unbearable. He arose and was about to set forth on his return when he suddenly realized that he had lost all idea of the way by which he had come to that spot. So he felt for the rock wall and another horror came upon him. His hand touched nothing. He felt on all sides, and there was nothing there. Then he went down on his hands and knees and crawled, first in one direction and then in another. By this means he at last discovered the fact that he was on a ridge, or causeway, of rock, which seemed to be some dozen to 18 yards wide, but from which point he had come upon it and when, he could in no wise remember. His ever-increasing perplexity, bordering on frenzy, would not allow him any rest. So he walked in the direction of the length of the rock into the darkness. Still the awful foreboding silence oppressed him. He felt that, in some indefinable way, it threatened him. On he went, and on, and the path did not end. He wondered why he did not fall off into the abyss below, on one side or the other. But he always found himself on firm ground. For this he had at first been thankful. But, as he toiled on and on, he became so weary of it all that he began to wish that an accident would happen to end his life, which he feared to take of his own will. Then, quite suddenly, a thought came to him and, once again, he sat down to think it out, in that black darkness and the silence of the void. This is an epitome of his meditations. Suicide? What use, when I have already died once, and have found myself alive and sensitive to pains I knew nothing of before, and in much worse case altogether. Instead of my quite enviable position as a successful practitioner, what have I suddenly changed into? Perhaps I haven't changed at all, and was what I am now all the time, but seemed different? When I thought I was a man of money, is it possible I was but a pauper? Perhaps it would be more true to say that I had the disposal of a certain fund which might fail at any moment. It did that, anyway, and now where am I, and what am I? By the way, those fools I met in that hovel said something about it. What was it? The girl I did not know, said it, something about my medical skill being more or less a sham because I did not realize the existence of another body permeating the body of the flesh. That is what I understood her. It to mean. I wonder if she is right after all. If she is, then medical science is on the wrong track, or partly so. At all events, here I am, and I understand those others to imply that I am dead, and yet I have a body still. If that young girl was right, this must be the body she spoke of, I suppose. P20 to then an access of frenzy came over him, and he stood up and shouted, "Ahoy there! Is there no one in this infernal wilderness? Ahoy!" But there was no answer except the silence, which was eloquent as any voice could be. He listened a while and then murmured, "Alone, and in eternity," and sank upon the ground once again and, burying his face in his hands, wept long and loudly. Long days, weeks and, dash years, seemed to go over him as he sat there. The silence had the effect of swallowing everything into its gigantic maw. It swallowed time, and all reckoning was quite in vain. He had shouted loudly, and wept loudly, and yet in his ears he only heard the voice and weeping of a very weak child, as if from a great distance. That is what lent despair to his thoughts when he had cried, "Alone, and in eternity." Commentrune. Some similar telling in the many transmissions from the other side and some similar books of the Swedish communicator Oscar Busch, some are translated, and also in book or film, Astral City, through Chico Xavier. Goes on from the book. At last he arose and, without aim, stumbled on and, as he went, he noticed that the ground had begun to rise. This at least was a variation to the awful monotony, and he welcomed it not a little. Presently he heard a faint sound, and hurried on in the direction from which it seemed to come. He lost it again, and again it returned, by which he surmised that he was no longer on an elevated path, but in a kind of valley, and that the surrounding hills or cliffs shut off, or admitted, the passage of sound according to their formation and disposition. As a matter of fact, he was only partly correct. He came at last to a place where a very faint light showed upon his right hand. He turned towards it eagerly and found it proceeded from a path which ran through a cleft in a cliff which, unknowingly, he had been approaching at an angle. He turned down this pass between the overhanging rocks. On his left the cliff soon fell away and he became aware that he was standing upon a ledge of rock with the cliff behind him faintly illuminated by a ruddy glow which had its origin in the plain below him. At first he could not clearly see what kind of country it was on which he gazed, but presently his eyes became more used to the elusiveness of what answered for light, and he was able to get some idea of the panorama. At the time when this current book of Vale Owen was taken down, was just the horrible WW1 ended with its millions of soldiers and civilians ill-skilled, dead, and so suddenly, unprepared, brought over to the other side. Often in complete confusion of what had happened to them, as described in the fantastic enthralling book Seven Steps to Eternity of Stephen Trough. Link plus no, DK Link, Friday, January 31, 1919. 5:40 to 7:30 PM. He sat there long, looking over the scene lying before him. From the foot of the cliff on which he reclined, to the horizon of low-lying hills, it was one undulating plain. Here and there he saw a tower, or a few scattered buildings, as if an attempt had been made by some community to establish a town. In every case failure seemed to have been the end of their efforts. A few scattered, stunted trees, a pool of dull-colored water, or a cluster of rocks, were characteristic of the landscape. All was in semi-darkness, and yet there was no mist to obscure. What was visible was seen in sharp outline, but yet dimly. Only here and there was a more pronounced glimmer of light to be observed, as where some fire burned, or where some building was lighted from within. But such light as there was only served to emphasize the gloom of that truly desolate region, and was faint and ruddy. There was not a ray of clear light anywhere to be seen. As to the sky, that was blackness, as if the great void of infinity held nothing in its abyss but dark emptiness. Paul felt the same oppressing sensation of threatening from without, and shrinking from within, as had assailed him when upon the mountain pass. And yet he shrank more from the darkness behind him, than from the lurid horror of the land which lay before down there below. He arose at last and began to descend towards the lowland. I will not stay to describe that descent. It was mostly made in the bed of what, in some fertile region, would have been a mountain watercourse,